KALW.
From KALW News in San Francisco, this is Cross Currents. Context, culture, and connection from around the Bay Area.
I live in Saratoga.
Presidio.
San Francisco, California, Excelsior District, District 11.
Coming up, we start our series of interviews with candidates for San Francisco mayor.
It's a tragic in Chinatown. You know, it used to be really bustling, but now it's the tourism is suffering.
Meet Wilma Pang. Then a big data project helps shed light on the achievement gap for students here in the Bay and across the country.
When we look at our data, there's no school district in the United States that doesn't have a large achievement gap.
And for today's audiograph, we're learning something new.
I walk my dog around here, and I saw that they had free lessons, and I just love the space.
Want to know where that is? Stay tuned. Cross Currents is coming up. Wilma Pang is an opera singer and a musician. She's also unsuccessfully run for public office in San Francisco several times. Now she's running to be the city's next mayor. She says she's a fierce advocate for Chinatown musicians, and she wants to improve the city's tourism industry by allowing artists to perform without worrying about fines. She speaks with KALW News Director Ben Trefney.
You say that you've run, this is your second or third time running. You're not
right.
Sure.
I'm not sure because I run for everything.
That's right. Why do you run for everything?
Well, my first run was a Board of Ed because, you know, I was a teacher. Last time I ran for mayor because I wanted to try for mayor. Mainly, I live and breathing in Chinatown. So, and a lot of the seniors who are monolingual, and merchants who are limited English, they don't speak enough English to be able to communicate to the politicians or to City Hall as the problems. Recently, it's been so many problems in Chinatown. You know, there's robberies and beating up seniors. And one of the most prominent leader was beaten up and robbed. So said, Wilma, why don't you speak up for us? And I think this is the main reason I'm speaking up for my community. Business is really, it's a tragic in Chinatown. You know, it used to be really bustling like Grand Avenue. You couldn't find a space, a storefront. But now it's like you walk through Grand Avenue, it's like there are three or four empty storefronts. And I think the rents are too high, and the tourism is suffering.
Well, do you think that the Central Subway, when it finally opens, will make a difference for Chinatown then?
Well, yes and no. Because right now, I heard that redo the tracks because it was all wrong. And it's going to postpone to at least another couple of years. And I think every day delay, there is business closing. So I don't know whether they're going to really help the merchants after it's complete.
I'm wondering about some other topics you've brought up that you want to speak out for women and seniors as well. What do you want to see done for them, like for women to begin with?
Well, women, mainly all these women working and a couple working can't afford childcare. So I think it's very, very critical problem for women.
So you think the city should have subsidized childcare?
Subsidized childcare or you know, I think they may have subsidized, but not enough.
How about for seniors?
The seniors, they live in, right now in Chinatown, I'm talking about, they live in a SRO, and right at the family's living in a room that's maybe half their size, that's crowding about four people in there. It's really not a good situation, but what can you do is you know, we can look into subsidizing, you know, housing for seniors and families.
So I'd like to move on to what we're going to call a lightning round. So I'd like you to keep your answers short, no more than a sentence for each of these.
Okay.
Let's start with ride sharing.
Yes. I think we should, you know, share more ride sharing. That's I'm for it.
Public transportation.
differently, because I think we work more on the Muni. There's a lot of complaining, but we should improve Muni.
How would you improve it?
Scheduling, and also get more, you know, like right now, drivers. You know, there's a problem with drivers. Train more drivers.
The cost of housing?
Probably more mobile homes, and maybe right now, subsidize vans and RVs, you know, to solve the crisis, you know. But it's a long-term thing.
How about social media?
Yes, I mean, you're talking about Facebook and all that. I think, yeah, it should regulate it, but, you know, we can't do too much about it.
How about climate change?
It's a really a bad problem. I think we should even think about that, you know, climate change. We should really think about how to solve this so huge problem. Like we don't hear about this forest burning like Amazon, and I think this is tragic.
As mayor of San Francisco, what would you do about climate change?
I think we should organize maybe groups to begin with, and organizations to really deal with it and really think. Don't just put ourselves in the sand, you know, in the head of the sand. We should really think about it. Even right now, San Francisco is fortunate enough that we don't get that kind of huge climate change. But look at it, Europe, this summer, Paris, you know, went up to 40, and it's just like it never happened before. And even the polar bears are dying, you know, so.
You show your international perspective by speaking in Celsius rather than Fahrenheit there.
That's Wilma Pang, candidate for San Francisco mayor. She was speaking with KALW's news director, Ben Trefney. And we'll be interviewing more candidates next week, so stay tuned. You're listening to Cross Currents from KALW News. I'm Hannah Baba. Sean Reardon taught in two schools as a young man, one on South Dakota's Pine Ridge Indian Reservation, one of the poorest places in the country, the other, a wealthy white school in New Jersey.
So it got me thinking about how and why do we have such unequal opportunity in America, and what are the sources of it, and importantly, what do we do about it?
Today, Reardon directs the Educational Opportunity Project at Stanford University. It uses big data to map our public schools by race, ethnicity, class, and test scores to get to the bottom of what's causing the achievement gap. And as of last month, it's available to anyone who wants to use it. KALW's education reporter Lee Romney talked to Reardon about the work.
I'm a professor of poverty and inequality at Stanford University, and I study education and the factors that make it more or less equal for kids.
Or unequal.
I like to look for the things that make it more equal. The disparities by race, by ethnicity, and by socioeconomic status are still, you know, unacceptably high in most of America. But I'm hopeful that by having the kind of easily accessible data that we've constructed and made available, that it will help people see the scope of the problem, but also find bright spots where we can hope to find some evidence of how to make progress on this.
Do you say data or data?
I say data.
Does it bug you when people say data?
It does not. I'm just happy that people are talking about it. There are about 13,000 elementary middle school districts in the country, and about 70,000 schools that serve elementary and middle school students, and those are the schools that we have the data for. About 50 million students, and we have about 350 million standardized test scores.
So there's a lot of critiques of test scores as a standard for a kid's ability.
We test children an enormous amount, and to reduce it to math and reading seems really narrow. So as measures of individual development, math and reading tests give us a very narrow slice. But as measures of educational opportunity in a community, I think they have more value. If the average test scores of kids in a community are systematically very high, that says the kids in that community have had lots of educational opportunity throughout their lives, in early childhood, in their homes, in their child care centers, in their neighborhoods, in their after-school programs, with their friends. The other thing that we can do with the test scores is we can look at how much they improve in a school or in a community as children progress from third to eighth grade. And if those scores are going up very fast, that says the kids are getting lots of opportunities to learn, even though they came in with pretty low scores. So the data we have can tell us something about when in kids' lives opportunities are higher or lower. And that can help us think about where's the smart investment.
Can you offhand think of a district or a school in California that kind of pops out as having less of an opportunity gap?
Let me look at our tool, which your listeners can do as well. A few places that show up as having higher achievement for their poor students than most other districts are San Marino Unified School District, Arcadia Unified School District, Monticello Elementary District, Temple City Unified. Most of those are in the kind of greater Los Angeles region. And those are places where test scores are generally well above average, both for the poor students and the non-poor students.
Those are places, at least from my time in Southern California, that I don't think they're overall poor communities.
It's true. Those are relatively affluent communities. And one thing we find is that low-income students generally do better in school. They have higher test scores when they're in less poor communities because they benefit from some of the resources of the surrounding community.
And this kind of speaks to the findings around segregation. Segregation has not been good for the gap.
No. So we've just finished a big study where we looked at the levels of racial segregation in every school district in the country. And then we looked at the size of the achievement gap or the opportunity gap between white and black students in each of those school districts. And we wanted to see the extent to which white and black students or white and Hispanic students attend different schools within the same district. Does that seem to lead to larger inequality of opportunity? And the answer seems to be yes. When segregation is higher, we see larger achievement gaps. Well, what's the mechanism? It turns out that the racial segregation itself is unrelated to the educational opportunities. What matters is the economic segregation. Today, still, race and ethnicity tend to be strongly related to economic circumstances. It's that poverty rate in the school that seems to be the driver. Schools with lots of poor students have trouble attracting and keeping the best teachers. They have fewer parents with high levels of economic or political resources who can advocate for the school, tend to have more students with special needs.
So I've spent the past year focusing on the experiences of black students and families in San Francisco Unified. Mm-hmm. Reading your conclusions led me to kind of wonder, how do we solve this?
I think if we're serious about improving educational opportunity and equality of educational opportunity, then thinking of ways and working on ways to reduce segregation has to be part of the solution. When we look at our data, there's no school district in the United States out of the thousands and thousands that has even moderately high segregation that doesn't have a large achievement gap. San Francisco has one of the largest gaps between white and black students' test scores of any school district in California, and indeed it's among the largest in the country. But San Francisco also has a huge difference in terms of the socioeconomic backgrounds of the white families and the black families who attend public schools, and that drives some of the achievement gap.
Do you know of ways, sort of short of court-ordered desegregation, to desegregate schools effectively?
San Francisco and some other places have tried using choice systems. Other options are creating magnet schools, creating dual language immersion programs, which attract students from different ethnic backgrounds. When you have to build a new school, thinking strategically about where you place it so that you'll get a more diverse mix of students. But given the residential segregation of the city, it's been not enough to overcome it.
Well, it's almost like you can't create a more integrated school unless you solve some of these other problems, right?
That's right. And so we need to think about housing policy that creates more integrated communities and neighborhoods. We need to think about economic policies at a national or a state level that create more economic opportunities.
This notion of a high poverty school, what if you flooded that school with resources, even though the kids are high poverty? Would that make a difference?
Well, it wouldn't hurt. But when you have a concentration of very poor students in a school, their neighborhoods often aren't as safe. Their families are under lots of stress. The school has to address a lot more than just, let's teach the kids to read. Let's make sure they know their numbers. And that requires lots of resources. But it's also hard to do that for every kid in the school. And so it's easier to sort of address those issues when you don't have them so concentrated in one place.
So say I'm a parent or a teacher. How can I use this data?
It's easy enough to go onto the district website or a state website and learn what the proficiency rate is of students in your school. But it's hard to learn anything about how much kids actually learn while they're in your school. Well, if you look at the learning rates, you're going to get a better information about what the school contributes to kids' knowledge and skills. The other thing you can do is you can pick a school or a district on the website, and then you can ask the website to find five schools or districts that are demographically similar, and then see how your school is comparing on different metrics to those similar schools or districts. Use it to ask your principal or superintendent, why don't we look as good as these other places that are like us, or what can we learn from them?
That was Stanford professor Sean Reardon speaking with KALW's education reporter Lee Romney. You can check out all that data. Go to edopportunity.org. And if you know of an education story you'd like to hear, contact Lee Romney at education@KALW.org. This is Cross Currents. I'm Hannah Baba. Next up, it's Audiograph. And today, we're going somewhere with sounds that many people find calming.
I walk my dog around here, and I saw that they had free lessons, and I just love the space. It's a very zen experience.
Want to know what that was and where we recorded it? Reporter Ian Lewis takes us there.
There are certain places in San Francisco that make you feel far away from a bustling metropolis, and this is one of them. It's 9 in the morning. I'm watching a group of men with long fishing poles wade out in water up to their waists. They're fly fishermen, the kind you'd likely find in a cold mountain stream, but here, we're far from the nearest river.
My name is Mehrdad Saberi, and we are at the Golden Gate Angling and Casting Club.
Since 1938, this club has given people who love to fly fish a place to practice, right here in the city.
I come here to do what I enjoy a lot, which is casting fly rods.
He's talking about getting a tiny, almost weightless lure, the fly, to land exactly where he wants it. Saberi makes it look easy, but really, being good at it takes lots of training and constant practice. Saberi says I can talk to him while he casts, but first, in order to know what fly fishing is really like, he wants me to take a lesson.
Today, you, Ian, are going to join me, Willie George, and we're going to learn how to fly cast. I'm going to help you a little bit. Is that cool?
That sounds
good.
Willie George is the president of the Golden Gate Angling and Casting Club. And like any great club, this one has a great clubhouse. Framed displays of handmade flies hang on the wall next to taxidermied fish. But today, we're here for the pools. Three rectangular concrete ponds. The only fish in these pools are tiny minnows. And those are to keep the mosquitoes down, not to catch. In fly fishing, though, if you're only interested in the fish, you're in the wrong sport.
I'm just here to work on my stroke, you know, like golfers do. It's the same thing with fishing, you know.
Paul Evans has been fly fishing for more than 30 years. And even he's come for a lesson today.
Because most of the time, We're all so damn polite today, we never tell each other what we're doing wrong. In any walk of life. You never walk up to a fisherman and say, you cast like a bum. Like that.
Okay.
Good.
Here we go. Yeah, you drop the elbow, that's the motion. Good.
Better. Good.
It's a very zen experience.
That's Kristen Stimson. Today is her third lesson. She first came across the pools while walking her dog in the park and decided to give it a try. Stimson's friend, Rosanna O'Rourke, wanted to come too.
I was like, can I please join you and crash your little party? Because I was heading to Montana a couple weeks after, and I wanted to learn before I actually went fly fishing.
In Montana, she caught a trout.
It was amazing. It was about this big.
So pretty.
I gather that it was a young trout, but no criticism from me. Here, I'm as green as it gets.
How many here have never cast a fly rod before?
That would be me. In the pools, there are bright floating rings a few feet across. They're targets to land your fly in. Some people here can hit the target from 100 feet. I'm not concerned about those. I just want the line to go out straight in front of me and not land in a pile by my feet.
There you go. That's it. Good hand position. Nicely done. It piled up a little bit. Do you see it?
Yeah.
Okay. Now this time, pretend you're trying to hit that sign over there.
Okay.
And you got a paintbrush in this hand, and I got to flick it and go whump and get the paint over there. Okay, now go. Flick that paintbrush. Best cast yet.
I think I'm ready to watch a real fly fisherman cast.
Hey, Ian, how are you?
Remember Mirdad Sabiri? The guy who got me interested in the first place?
Good to see you, man. This is a beautiful bamboo rod that one of our distinguished members has made, and I'm casting it right now.
When Sabiri casts, his shoulder, arm, and wrist move fluidly, and the rest of his body is still. His gaze is always directed on the water, right where he wants the fly to land. And pretty much every time, that's where it lands.
Fly fishing gives you the opportunity to really express all the things you strive for in life and demonstrate it in your cast.
The chance to get better and better is one of the reasons he comes here. It's also a way for him to connect with his Persian culture. Sabiri was born in Iran and moved to San Francisco in 1979 when he was 11.
The Persian culture is heavy duty into poetry. Rumi and Hafez and what have you. And fly fishing and fly casting basically brings the physical elements of sports and sportsmanship and competition and the poetic side of the culture together for me. And it's all an expression of what's in your mind. I'm a sucker for that. I feel it's my temple. You know, I feel meditation. It's my religion, I think.
Sabiri hasn't always felt welcome in the U.S., but here, it's different.
You know, here I am among these incredible people that have all the reasons in the world to be a little reserved. Yet they have absolutely open, welcoming arms, and they judge you by who you are, your character, and your love for the sport. And the sport brings us all together, huddled around, you know, these ponds. So we're lucky to have them here.
And no fish necessary. For Cross Currents, I'm Ian Lewis.
Thanks, Ian. You can find more audiographs just like that at our website, kalw.org. That's also where you can make sure you're subscribed to the Cross Currents newsletter. Tune in Monday at 5. Our partners in California prisons are coming out with a new series.
You know, mainly I like to present stories that show that people are making good use of their time to change. Art, music, redemption, recovery. That's where I come from.
Why?
It reflects on who I am and my drive in life, trying to make something out of this time that I've been wasting in prison.
Uncuffed, made in California prisons. Hear the debut Monday at 5 on Cross Currents. And before we go, here's some local music. This is guitarist James Robinson from Campbell. He's performing at Cascale in Mountain View this Saturday. Today's Cross Currents team includes Janae Darden, Julia Linus Goodman, Kristen McCandless, True Gwynn, Marissa Ortega Welch, and Victor Tense. Our engineers are James Rollins, Tariq Foda, and Gabe Graben. Content manager is Shirin Adil. Our managing editor is David Boyer. Deputy news director is Angela Johnston. News director is Ben Trefney. Our opening theme music is by the John Santos Quintet. For Cross Currents, I'm Hannah Baba.